everyone. If we haven't met yet, my name's Alex. I'm one of the pastors here at Artisan Church. This morning, we're going to be continuing in our series on the Beatitudes. And this series, it's part of a larger journey that we've been on as a church since September, where we've been exploring a few different themes that we feel are important for our community, where God might be leading our community into. And they're based around three words, and those words are healing, community, and imagination. And so in the fall, we did some exploration of that word healing and what that might look like for us. In 2025, this winter, we're exploring that second word, community. And we're using the Beatitudes as a lens through which we might consider what it means to be a community. So we're asking questions like, what is our nature as a church? And what does it mean to be the body of Christ in this time, in this place, as Artisan, in the downtown east side of Vancouver and in our neighborhoods in 2025? And so for the last few weeks, we've been in maybe what I would call like the Beatitudes proper, like the blessed are statements. And those statements are one of the most well-known passages of Scripture. I think certainly they're one of the most well-known teachings of Jesus. And Aaron introduced the Beatitudes and helped us see them through an honor-shame lens. And that was based around the honor-shame code that dictated much of social life in first century Palestine. And so in looking at it through that lens, we've explored how the Beatitudes is actually Jesus's way of flipping that code on its head when he describes who God honors and who God is with, who has honor in the kingdom, who is God present with. And that idea of presence is, I think, really, really key and important as we move into the next section of Jesus' sermon. Because again, in it, like, this is the Sermon on the Mount. It's kind of like greatest hits, I feel like, Jesus' greatest hits. And so this one is another just banger. Jesus uses one of the most recognizable metaphors in Scripture in this passage we're looking at when he refers to his followers as salt and light. And so this happened to me this morning. So salt and light, I got a speeding ticket on the way to church. And so I'm here to tell you how to be a good citizen and influence after receiving that ticket. And it was at a place where I had previously been pulled over, exact same place, coming off the highway onto McGill, and I had been warned. So I'd been given grace. Almost 3 months later, busted. So, I mean, I just had to take it. It's fine. It's okay. I can handle it. So this text, Salt and Light, it's one that I'm sure many of us are very familiar with. And when it comes to texts like this, I'm always really curious how other people have understood them, or perhaps the journey that other folks have been on with passages like this, because like so many of Jesus' teachings, he's pretty enigmatic with it. Like, he doesn't do much direct explaining or just answer giving. You know, when Jesus teaches, he tends to have a habit of just kind of leaving statements and teachings suspended in midair, as it were, for us to kind of walk around and examine and ask questions about and explore. And so I want to do that this morning a little bit. Just to start off, we won't take too much time, but I want to give 2 minutes for us to just consider this together. And I would love, if you feel comfortable sharing, to share what might be coming up for you when you hear this passage read. So I'm going to read it. It's on the screen as well if you want to look at it. And just notice what's going on inside of you. Anything coming up could just be a noticing or a question or a wondering or maybe even pushback or challenge to it. And if you feel comfortable, I would just love to hear how does this land with you? How does this hit you? So let's read this together. This is Jesus speaking to his followers. He says, "You are the salt of the earth. But if salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. And you are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Just take 2 minutes. And if you feel comfortable, what's landing for you? What's coming up for you? Yeah. Generous, the metaphors are generous. Light is generous, salt is generous. They're giving. Yeah. Right. Right. Like obvious, okay. Salt is salt, light is light. Yeah. Yeah. How in the world is, yeah. Right, yeah. How does salt lose its saltiness? You know, you can hide a light, but how does salt lose, how does it stop being salt? What happens? Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. Right, maybe some sarcasm there, or some, rhetorical, right? Salt can't stop being salt, light can't stop being light, yeah, yeah. Without saying words, yeah. Maybe the see your good deeds shine, yeah, yeah. Something different. Yeah. Let. Right. Yeah, that word let. There's no conjuring there. There's no trying there. It just happens. Maybe one more. I saw Rhonda. Had her hand up, yeah. Okay, one more because you asked. Right. Right. Rhonda, thank you for sharing that. I feel like, you know, even that line that Jesus says, a city on a hill, right? Like, how has that been used, you know, by empire, right? Even think about what's happening down south and the way that Western empire has used literally that line as like, we're the shining light on the hill for the world to see. And the complete, you know, you could argue the complete opposite has happened. They've actually been a force of destruction and oppression. And so, yeah, it's easy to read these and go, oh, I don't know, you know, how do you take this? I know that in my kind of younger, in my late teens and in my early 20s, when I was young and energetic and zealous. You know, I remember, I'm not any of those things anymore, by the way. I remember viewing this primarily as a missional text, right? Like a call to leverage positive influence as a means to an end, and that end being transforming others. And while I do definitely think that there is an aspect of this passage in which Jesus calls his followers to be a force for good in the world, I do wonder if in our rush to be influential in the world that we've forgotten how to be present to it, that we want that influence, but we don't want to do the work of presence. We're not really willing to be present. We kind of want to parachute in, have the influence, but not be with. And so drawing from that idea of presence, I want to offer just one angle. Obviously, with a passage like this, there's so many ways we could go with it. The challenge of preaching is like, say one thing, don't say all the things. And so I want to offer just one angle from which we might view these words of Jesus, and that is one of understanding salt and light as witnessing presence, witnessing presence. And what I don't mean by that is like getting out there and making cold calls for Jesus. I mean instead, when I say witnessing presence, I mean committing to being present in and to the world in a way that awakens ourselves and others to where God might be found and what God might be up to. Being present to and in the world in a way that awakens ourselves and others to where God might be found and what God might be up to. For those of us who were here last week, Jody said something in her interview with Aaron that was just so wonderfully profound, that I felt like I just had to share it again. She was doing an interview-style sermon with Aaron about peacemaking. We were in that beatitude. And Aaron asked her a question, just really straightforward. Why peacemaking? Why should Christians pursue peacemaking? And her answer was so wonderful. And I think it really is pertinent to what we're talking about today with salt and light. So I just want to read it to you. It's also on the screen. Why peacemaking? She said, "Something new is being birthed. And I think that the church has an opportunity to be saved in this time and season as we reorient ourselves from being about the things that make us feel safe and orient ourselves towards being people pursuing the new ecosystem that God is bringing about and then living in that fully in ways that are a witness to something new that God is doing in the world." I love that because she describes this movement. There's a movement there, a movement from safety and comfort towards an intentional posture of presence and attentiveness to where God already is and what God is already doing. And in one sense, it's a difficult movement, I think, because it asks us, some of us, to decenter ourselves. But in another sense, it actually leads to us being saved, as Jody put it, I think, from missing God, that it saves us from missing out on what God is doing. And that decentering actually then becomes quite freeing because it removes, like Nikki shared, I think, the burden of conjuring something up, conjuring up some light, conjuring up some saltiness, the pressure of putting on a brave face, and it invites us instead to just be present. Just be here, be present. And so I want to look quickly at these two metaphors, salt and light, and with this question in mind, how might witnessing presence shape or maybe reshape the way we understand these metaphors? And I'll offer a few understandings that got said this morning and that I think many of us have heard. And then I want to end with one that is new and not in the Bible. But we'll get there when we get there. So let's start with salt. You are the salt of the earth. How does salt witness? It's kind of a weird thing to think about. How does salt witness? Well, like it was mentioned, salt seasons, right? The presence of salt in a meal, what does it do? It witnesses to the flavors that are already present in that dish. And actually, a well-seasoned meal does not taste like salt, right? If you're tasting salt, too much salt. When well used, salt, a lot like love, doesn't seek to overpower or dominate or drown out flavor. Instead, it actually dissolves into the ingredients. Somebody mentioned melting, but I think when salt dissolves into the ingredients, it's actually good because it goes deep and it brings out, it draws out the best of what those ingredients have to offer. Salt blesses, like Bree said, it blesses the food that it goes into. Salt also preserves, that got mentioned as well. Its presence attends to what is already good by keeping it that way. It dignifies, it protects, and holds what otherwise might be in danger of being lost or discarded. It witnesses to the goodness of food that is good by protecting it. And so then, if being salt is about being, if we see salt through being a witnessing presence that attends to and preserves what is already good and what has already been called good, then what might it look like then for us to lose our saltiness? Because there's that warning that Jesus gives, like if the salt loses its saltiness, then what good is it? And I actually don't really want to answer that question this morning. I just want to leave it there. If salt is being witnessing presence, then what might it look like for us to lose our saltiness? Okay, light. How does light witness? Again, like it was said, light reveals. Like when we turn on a light in a room, it doesn't add or take away from anything that's in that room. It simply reveals what's already there and helps us to be present and witness to what is already there, or maybe what or who isn't there that ought to be. It witnesses to what's in the room. Light also draws in and invites. Jesus says a city built on a hill can't be hidden, right? Like if you've ever had this experience, like a warm pub or a warm, cozy coffee shop on a cold, dark night is a pretty tough thing to resist when you're walking on the street. It's just like, ooh, that looks good. It's like, well, we just ate. It's like, yeah, but I'm cold. And that looks warm. It invites us in, asking us to stay a while, rest, be present. Light also evokes presence. I think light has that ability to evoke presence in us. I don't really think it's a coincidence that the types of conversations that we have when we're sitting around bonfires are quite a bit different than the ones we have when we're sitting around boardroom tables under fluorescent lights. Around fires, we tell stories, we make jokes, we share deeply, and it seems like we're more easily present to the moment, to each other. And I've actually, like, I don't know about you, but have you ever, like, I feel when I'm sitting around a fire, I'm usually with people I really love and care about, but it feels kind of weird to pull out a phone in that situation. It feels kind of like you pull out your phone, and it almost feels like rude or crass, you know, to choose to stare at the cold, dim light of this little tiny rectangle when there's the burning, crackling warmth and radiance of a bonfire right there. It's like, man, what am I doing? You just put it back in your pocket. It's like, be here, be present. Daniel Wolpert, he's an author and he's a contemplative. He talks about salt and light this way. He says, both salt and light are facilitators. Salt allows us to notice the other tastes in food. Light allows us to see objects around us. And powerful presence is the practice of creating an empty space so that God's spirit may be noticed in the crowded human space that is generally full of clutter and distraction. In such an open setting, the spirit has room to move and work, and suddenly, an environment that felt ordinary or stuck or devoid of life begins to transform. So as we practice witnessing presence in the world, it's about creating that spaciousness that allows for God to be noticed, because God is already here. God's already here. God's already working. Our saltiness brings the flavor of God, as it were, to the surface of the world's palate. It's like, hey, can you taste this? God is here. Our light reveals where the divine might be found and invites and invokes people to be present to God. Okay, so are you guys ready to get exegetically crazy now? Yeah, let's do it. It's not that crazy, don't worry, it's okay. There's a different way that we could view salt and light. It's a very Canadian way. And it came from a conversation Aaron and I were actually having a few weeks ago about this. And it's that salt melts and light warms. And I do not think that Jesus had that metaphor or had that in mind. I don't think Jesus spent a lot of time walking on snowy, icy pathways. But I think he would approve. I think he would approve. Because we can be creative. And I think the thawing effect of salt and light maybe is really badly needed right now. Like, think about the cultural moment that we find ourselves in. It just feels extremely overwhelming at times, right? Like, there are things happening at levels that are so far above our heads and beyond our ability to control, right? Like tariffs, and they're just unprecedented, right? Like geopolitically, nationally, locally, we have wars, tariffs, rights are being taken away, governments are cutting funding to the most vulnerable. And then all this is happening just on top of like the daily needs and responsibilities of life, you know, food, money, family, housing, work. And in the overwhelm, I wonder if the strongest reaction isn't towards fight or flight, but towards freezing. Like to just shut down, to just turn inward, to tune out, to go numb. Just close our eyes and stop being present. Stop being present to ourselves, to God, to the world around us. And maybe that's where salt and light come in. Maybe that's where we need to be salty. Maybe that's where our light needs to shine. That's the work that it needs to be doing, is that thawing effect. And I think that's where perhaps the magic of this passage is. I don't think the magic is necessarily in the metaphors of salt and light. I think the magic is in who Jesus is saying this to. Jesus looks out into the crowds, and what does he see? We're told in Matthew 4 that people hear that Jesus is healing, and so they just start bringing folks. They brought to him those who were ill with various diseases, those suffering severe pain, the demon-possessed, people having seizures, the paralyzed, and then that's on top of just the general crowd who are mostly made up of a colonized people with almost no rights living under the military occupation of empire. That's who Jesus is looking at when he's saying these words. He looks at them and he calls them the salt of the earth and the light of the world. Nadia Bowles Weber puts it this way. She says, nowhere in the Sermon on the Mount does Jesus say, here are the conditions you must meet in order to be salt of the earth. He does not say, here are the standards of wholeness that you must fulfill in order to be light for the world. No, he simply looks out into the crowd of people in pain, people who have been broken open, who bear those spiritual cracks that let in the light, who have the salt of sweat and tears on their broken bodies, and says, you are salt, you are light. In other words, the salt of the earth and the light of the world are just the people who happen to be standing in the need of God. And standing in the need of God is standing in the way of blessedness in a way that already having it all together never has been. Frederick Bruner, in his commentary on Matthew, says in the you are statements that Jesus is making, he's ordaining disciples. He's just walking around ordaining, you are, you are, you are, you are. He's ordaining, commissioning, as it were. This past week, I asked somebody, I was emailing with somebody from our community, Ronnie Grigg. Many of you will know Ronnie. And I asked him to offer some of his thoughts on this passage. I was curious what somebody like Ronnie, who has worked and lived in the downtown East Side for many years, thinks about this passage. Ronnie is the director of Zero Block Society, which is an organization that champions harm reduction and supports frontline workers. And I asked him if he would reflect on how his understanding of salt and light has changed over the years, and maybe how he's understanding and hearing those words right now. And I want to share just a little bit of what he had to say. He said, I hope I'm approaching salt and light in a transformed and redemptive manner. The reason for that is because of loss. I feel like we're losing the struggle to be compassionate, losing the message that caring for those who suffer matters, that those who are positioned to respond to these matters are to blame for the problems rather than the people to be supported and celebrated. Losing hurts. I'm not sure, but maybe this is what the world is truly like, and it needs our light in order to endure our human experience. I'm viewing salt and light as being the basic needs of that struggle. As so many begin to identify with struggling and suffering, we need each other more than ever, and the notions of mutual aid, community care, and solidarity in the struggle are more important than ever. Think of the generational trauma of Indigenous nations or the African American experience most visible in the US. The models of community, caring for each other, the broad identification of family, and the cultural expressions that emerge in the long shadow of great loss, to me, that is salt and light, joy, resilience, music, art, being undefeatable. A few weeks ago, we had an impromptu lament service after Scott's mom passed away suddenly. And as the staff, at that gathering, I really took, some of us were there for that. And as a staff, that gathering really took us by surprise in how strongly it resonated with the community. And one thing we took away from that service was just how much struggle and pain and grief was being carried in the room and is carried in the room when we gather as a church. And I wonder if the reason that gathering was really healing and formative for us was because we were in that moment being really intentional about being present to ourselves and to each other, both in our own grief, but also in the grief and struggle of others. Like, is it possible that being willing to be present to grief and struggle, that we realized that God was already there? Like, if we were just be present to it, if we'd just be willing to just be there, that we realize, wow, God is actually already there. And I wonder if maybe that gives us a glimpse of what it might look like to be a community that stands as a witnessing presence to the work of God in the world. I think that's the uniqueness of the church, because there is a sense of uniqueness in this. Like, Jesus is saying, hey, you are light and salt, which is different than what is happening out in the world. So there's a sense of uniqueness, and I wonder if that's the call to uniqueness, is our ability or our willingness, not even ability, it's just a willingness to be present to where God is and what God might already be doing. I wonder if Jesus, being a good rabbi, when he said these words and used this metaphor of salt and light, if he had Psalm 34 in mind. Psalm 34, 8 says that, David writes, he says, "Taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the one who takes refuge in him." And actually, if you read the rest of that chapter, like Psalm 34 and the Beatitudes, you could just hold them up side by side and you could just cross-reference all day long. You just nerd out on it. They're very similar. I wonder if that's what Jesus had in mind here. Taste and see, salt and light. Jesus is like, I can help you taste and see. Jesus is the salt that helps us taste the goodness of God, and he's the light that helps us to see the goodness of God's new work around us if we are willing to see it. There's a willingness that's needed. And so I wonder what that might look like for Artisan. I think it's something to maybe think about as a community. Like, what might it look like for us to be a witnessing presence to what God is already doing in our community? And we had a really good, I think a really great experience when we actually did that. I think we found God when we lamented together. And I wonder if more of that isn't needed, that thawing work of salt and light, that refusal to freeze and to shut down and to turn inward, and an insistence on being present to ourselves and to each other and to God. And so we're gonna come to the table now as a way of acknowledging Jesus's presence to the goodness of God. Jesus' presence among us as we follow him. And at the table, I think the light of Jesus beckons us to come from the cold, dark streets. Come in, eat a meal with him. Eat the meal that he's prepared for us. It's perfectly seasoned with the goodness of God. So we're gonna read the liturgy together, and after we read the liturgy, you can come up. Just come up these diagonals.